Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, as communities across the country shut down their incinerators, Sullivan County may build a new one, but not everyone is on board. A coalition of activists gathered in Monticello this week to push back, and Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar was there. We'll have her report coming up. What's really happening between Albany and the rest of New York State? Who's shaping policy behind the scenes? The Capitol Press Room takes you inside state politics with expert analysis and unexpected insights. And it's joining our weekday schedule on Monday. We'll get a preview with host Dave Lombardo. She's toured the country, but tomorrow she's back where it all began. Hometown artist Michaela Rain makes her debut at the headlining Hurleyville Performing Arts Center. And how the Rotary Club of Honesdale is changing lives. First, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Despite threats of mass firings from President Trump, some federal workers say they're in favor of holding out in the spending fight that sparked the government shutdown that's now on its second day. From member station WAMU, Jenny Abamu has more.
Federal workers showed up alongside Democrats on Capitol Hill to show their support for holding firm on extending Affordable Care Act subsidies. Elizabeth Riley, a USDA employee, says she's no more afraid of losing her job during the shutdown than she was before it.
We've been under attack for 9 months as federal workers, and this is just another day at work. Although we aren't working, a lot of my colleagues are going to struggle missing a paycheck, but a lot of us also feel that they need to hold the line.
Democratic lawmakers such as Jamie Raskin in Maryland, whose district hosts over 50,000 federal workers, says constituents have been calling and emailing his office saying, hold the line. For NPR News, I'm Jenny Abamu on Capitol Hill.
In Manchester, England, police say at least two people are dead, several others injured, after a car ramming and stabbing at a synagogue as people gathered for Yom Kippur, the holiest day on the Jewish calendar. Police say the suspect was shot by police and is also dead. The attack happened in a part of the city that's home to many Orthodox Jews. Manchester Mayor Andy Burnham.
It is a serious incident, but at the same time, I can give some reassurance immediately to people that the immediate danger appears to be over, and Greater Manchester Police have dealt with it very quickly, and has been amazing support from, I think, members of the public and security at the location.
Speaking there to the BBC, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer says he was appalled by the attack. Security at synagogues around the UK has been increased. Stocks opened higher this morning amid news of a big computer chip deal. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow rose about 75 points in early trading.
Stocks and computer chip makers around the world are getting a boost after a couple of South Korean companies announced a deal to supply memory chips to OpenAI. It's the latest sign of how the artificial intelligence boom is powering chip makers, not only in South Korea and Taiwan, but here in the U.S. as well. Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway is buying Occidental Petroleum's chemical division in a deal valued at nearly $10 billion. The acquisition could be the last big purchase for Buffett. The billionaire investor is stepping down as Berkshire's CEO at the end of this year. On Thursdays, we usually get a weekly report on unemployment claims, a good proxy for layoffs. No news this week, though. The report was sidetracked by the federal government shutdown. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
And on Wall Street, the Dow is up 61 points. The Nasdaq is up 60 points, and the S&P 500 is up 6. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Glaciers in California's mountains are disappearing fast and will likely be gone by the end of the century. Daniel Benton from member station KQED reports, in new research, geologists found that these glaciers predate humans' arrival in the Americas.
Scientists used to think that glaciers in the Sierra Nevada had shrunk and regrown over time, as other glaciers have. But by studying isotopes in glacial bedrock, they found the state's glaciers have not melted during the last 20,000 years. That means there's no precedent for glaciers disappearing from the state since human settlement. Researcher Andrew Jones says human-caused global warming is melting California's glaciers.
I mean, you hear about 2 degrees Celsius of warming. Right. And to most people, that's just this imperceivable difference on their home thermostat. But our findings here are tangible.
Jones says if in the future the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere were to decrease, glaciers could stabilize and even return. For NPR News, I'm Danielle Venton in San Francisco.
A legendary skateboard belonging to Tony Hawk just sold for a record-breaking $1.5 million. It's the board he used to make history in 1999, landing the first 900 trick at the San Francisco X Games, where, after 10 failed attempts, he finally succeeded, thrilling the crowds. The auction also included other Hawk memorabilia, with proceeds benefiting the Skate Park Project, which is his nonprofit foundation. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Communities across the country are figuring out how to close their incinerators, but Sullivan County is considering building a new one. Earlier this summer, the county issued a draft RFP for a waste-to-energy facility as part of its broader plans to prepare for the region's anticipated growth of trash in the next decade. On Monday evening, a coalition of activists organized an emergency town hall in Monticello to push back against the proposal. Radio Catskills' Kimberly Izar reports.
Local community members and environmental activists are pushing back against the proposal to build a new incinerator in Sullivan County that would burn trash and convert it into electricity.
We don't want to die from the air we breathe. We already have a high rate of health issues related to the air we breathe here in Sullivan County. Other counties are running away from this idea. Why is Sullivan County so into it?
More than 100 people filled the Black Library on Broadway in Monticello on Monday night to learn more about the county's waste-to-energy proposal. The town hall was organized by local environmental and racial justice groups, including Sustainable Sullivan, Sullivan County's NAACP, the Black Library, and the Energy Justice Network. Sullivan County resident Annette Foy says the county has other problems to worry about than building an incinerator.
We say no to waste energy proposal in our backyard. We currently have community leaders that through greed and selfishness feel burning waste from across the regions would generate revenue for the county. For what? A county that takes investing in an airport that most of us will never even see because it's in a place we don't even know.
Our international
or casino
airport.
Being sustained. Or roundabout traveling circle. Over mental health, drug addiction, a gateway shelter to addiction, to address addiction and homelessness. Just to name a few, y'all.
Earlier this summer, Sullivan County issued a draft RFP for the development of a waste-to-energy facility as part of its long-term sustainability goals. These incinerators create energy by mass-burning trash and converting it into heat and electricity. But pediatrician and environmental health expert Dr. Stephen Goldstein says it's not that simple.
What is left leaves the plant as ash, some of which contains metals that can be recycled, with the rest ending up in landfills. The rest of what is left leaves that plant in emissions into the air. Those emissions can profoundly affect air quality and the risk of disease.
Many of the emissions left behind are too small to be seen with the naked eye, and they can have serious health risks.
These tiny particles can be absorbed into the body from the lungs or intestinal tract and then go into the bloodstream and are associated with not only heart and lung disease, but also an increased risk of dementia in all age groups. Dioxins are formed from incomplete combustion in incinerators and from industry. They make their way into the food supply through air and water.
The incinerator proposal is in response to Sullivan County's big question. Where will its garbage go? The county's solid waste contract with Seneca Meadows expires at the end of 2025. Tipping fees for both residents and haulers have increased, and county legislators are looking for new ways to stimulate the economy. District 5 legislator Kat Scott said that at first, the idea of building a facility in the county sounded like an opportunity.
It sounded good, right? we're going to get rid of this trash, which is a really expensive problem to have, and we're going to make some energy with it, right? Sounds good. It wasn't until Rebecca and Eric and other citizens started showing up to meetings and informing us about what some of those dangers were.
Scott, who chairs the county's Health and Human Services Committee, says that's when she started learning about the health risks for people living near incinerators. Poor air quality, higher rates of asthma, and climate threats like crop damage and extreme weather conditions. She says an incinerator could affect the people already struggling to make ends meet the most.
This incinerator is a fairy tale. It's a Grimm's fairy tale. It's not the Disney fairy tale, right? It's the one that ends in a lot of bloodshed and screaming. But it is a fairy tale that some people have latched on to. But I just want to caution you all that there is some very real economic issues involved in solid waste. And when people are frustrated and you're trying to talk to them, and just understand that. They got a $700 electric bill. They have a mortgage. And grocery prices keep going up. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be a real challenge. It doesn't mean we don't fight it. It doesn't mean we don't try. It just means that we have to listen with our hearts when some people are talking to us very frustrated because they don't know the information we know and they might not put the same importance on it. But those are the folks that are going to end up with the, you know, bad birth weights or the cancers or the whatever, right? Those are the people that always get targeted because they can't afford to fight back.
The county's Division of Public Works Commissioner Ed McAndrew told Radio Catskill that the legislature will review all environmental health impacts this proposal could have if it moves forward.
That will be done in depth once, if they go to the next step, say if an RFP actually results in a vendor coming forward that wants to do this, you would have to look at what technologies they're going to use and how that would be, and it will be reviewed in detail in in-depth scrutiny with New York State DEC, and I'm sure the EPA has air emission standards that may apply to it as well on any emissions from that.
McAndrew says legislators are looking at the closed landfill in Monticello as a potential site.
But that doesn't mean that it would be permitted there. It might be, it might not be. That would be up to, like I said, the whole environmental process that has to go through is going to be extensive and rigorous.
Mike Ewall is the founder and director of the Energy Justice Network. It's a national network fighting dirty energy facilities for more than 25 years. He says even the term waste to energy is meant to confuse the public. First, these incinerators were called resource recovery facilities.
And then they switched it up and now it's waste to energy. And that's the term that is being used in your county right now in legal documents to contract and attract these companies here. But that's also a misleading term because no one is violating the laws of physics and turning matter into energy without a nuclear reaction. Thankfully, that's not what these plants do. So they're turning trash into toxic ash and toxic air emissions, but they call it waste to energy to make you think bad things go in, good things come out. And you're not supposed to think beyond that.
The last time a new incinerator was built in the United States was in 2015 in Palm Beach County, Florida. It cost $672 million. Before that, 1995 in Connecticut. For the communities that have active incinerators, many of them have plans to close them as the facilities age.
The average lifespan of the 54 that closed since year 2000 was just 26 years old. And yet the ones that we have here in New York and for the most part in the whole country are between 30 and 45 years old. So all of these incinerators are going to be closing probably in the next decade, most of them.
One of the vendors who's expressed interest in building the county an incinerator is ReWorld. It's a New Jersey-based company previously known as Covanta, and it has a long backlog of hundreds of permit violations, fines, and lawsuits in communities where they have built the plant. In February, New York State's Department of Environmental Conservation fined ReWorld more than $878,000 for mishandling the plant's ash at its Hempstead facility. Ewell says those fines are not enough to change bad behavior.
Sometimes they'll get fines, and even like that $800,000 fine they got on Long Island, that turned out to be about, I think it was somewhere between maybe 3 and 5 days at most, of their tipping fee revenues. So they make that back in less than a week. You're not harming them. They are not changing their behavior.
Some communities have even gone bankrupt. Oftentimes, these incinerators have a put or pay clause. It's a requirement in the contract that says a community must feed the incinerator a certain amount of waste, or they pay the difference. Alicia Santiago, vice president of Sullivan County's NAACP, says the county is considering Monticello because its large Black and brown population.
14 of the 28 largest incinerators are in Black and brown communities. Black people are most disproportionately impacted because trash impactors in communities are surrounded by 2.5 times more people than those of white communities. We cannot let corporate greed and political power exploit our community. Trash incinerators will harm our environment, violates our human rights, and further suppresses our community. We have to take a stand on this inequality because our lives depend on it.
This is not the first time the county has considered an incinerator in Monticello, says longtime resident Vivian Ginsburg. In the 1990s, medical waste company Stericycle wanted to build an incinerator in the county.
And we fought and fought and fought, and they took their tail between their butts and left. So it can be done, and it was for the same reason. They considered Sullivan County the armpit of New York and the country, basically. We were impoverished. They figured a bunch of yahoos here, nobody's going to do anything about it. So part of my frustration is the current legislators are not studying history.
Ginsburg worries that the fight has continued 30 years later. While there are new vendors and legislators, she says it'll impact the same communities. But Monday's town hall speakers say there's hope. From Los Angeles to Delaware County, Pennsylvania, communities have already adopted zero waste plans aimed at diverting waste through reducing, reusing, and recycling. Others have found ways to make landfills less harmful to the communities that they're in. Finally, there's voting, especially at the local level.
There are multiple levels of government that can solve this for us. And we need to decide where we're going to focus our energy if we want to stop this. It is always easiest to stop things at the most local level of government.
That will require residents to mobilize. Resident Annette Foy says communities have the power to decide who makes these decisions.
Remember, we vote them in, and we can vote them out.
Yes.
DPW Commissioner Ed McAndrew anticipates the county will issue a final RFP later this fall. In Monticello, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
Thanks, Kimberly. Now, turning to the government shutdown and local and regional impact, in just a few months, many lower and middle income families could start paying a lot more for insurance. That's because federal health care subsidies are set to expire at the end of this year. The Republican-controlled Congress says it doesn't plan to extend them, and it's become the focal point in the current government shutdown, with Democrats insisting the subsidies be extended before they'll vote for a funding extension. Amy Feyresel from the New York Public News Network reports on what the loss of those subsidies would mean for New Yorkers.
Many people have never heard of the Affordable Care Act subsidies, even if they use them. They were originally created as part of Obamacare in 2012. They helped people pay for insurance who made too much to qualify for Medicaid, but made less than 4 times the federal poverty level. That means individuals making up to $60,000 each year. Health insurance for that person can cost around $12,000 a year.
$12,000 out of $60,000 is impossible, especially in a country in which 40% of the people do not have $500 to meet an emergency car or medical expense.
That's Chris Hoy, a recently retired physician who's lived and worked in northern New York for over 3 decades. His last job was with the Hudson Headwaters Health Network Clinic in Queensbury.
The tax credits became the way of allowing people to afford health care.
Especially small business owners, their employees, and people who work multiple jobs. Then the subsidies really ramped up when they were expanded in 2021 under the American Rescue Plan. That got another 12 million Americans on health insurance. And Hoy says it helped get New York's uninsured rate down to a staggeringly low 5%.
Finally arriving at something that essentially is universal health care for people in New York State.
But here's the thing. Most people don't know they're getting an Affordable Care Act subsidy. And that's because they're not labeled as such, says Hoy. When you search for insurance through the New York marketplace, you put in information like where you live and your income, and it gives you choices, none of which have a big red sign saying Medicaid.
The vast majority of people do not know that the marketplace is Medicaid. They don't know that the essential plan is Medicaid.
But that's exactly what Republicans see as the problem, that Medicaid has gotten too big. They say it needs to revert back to its original mission of providing insurance for only the very poor and the disabled. Cutting Medicaid back, including the expanded subsidies, was a central part of President Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill Act. Democrats, like New York Senator Chuck Schumer, say the Affordable Care Act subsidies play a crucial role in the U.S. healthcare system. Without them, he says care will be inaccessible to many lower and middle income families.
And if you don't extend the Obamacare tax credits, people's premiums are going to go up $400-$500 a month, and they're going to start learning about that when they get the notices in October.
The New York State Department of Health says the subsidies support almost 2 million New Yorkers through marketplace plans and the state essential plan. If they expire, it estimates that average premiums statewide will rise by nearly 40%. That looks like a couple paying about $250 more per month for their insurance,
which is $3,000 annually. That's a big chunk.
Duncan Ryan Mann is an economics professor at SUNY Empire. He's been studying and teaching healthcare policy for over 40 years. He says the impacts of those raised premiums will be people giving up their insurance.
People have to pay a higher price for health insurance, and that's going to discourage people from buying it.
Especially younger, healthier people willing to risk it. Ryan Mann says that leads to something called adverse selection.
People that are less likely to need the insurance coverage will tend to opt out versus those people that need the insurance coverage will keep it. So on average, medical, the cost to those insurers is going to go up.
Insurers then pass that cost on in the form of even higher monthly payments for everyone else. Chris Hoy, the former Queensbury physician, is now a member of the Healthcare Coalition for the North Country. That group formed this spring with a mission of preserving Medicaid in the region, where a third of the population depends on it. Hoy says as people lose their subsidies, and some then drop their insurance, that will stress local hospitals because uninsured people don't seek primary or preventative health care.
By the time it gets bad enough, they end up going and have a much more advanced state of disease and suddenly end up in an emergency situation and go to the emergency room. They have no insurance. The hospital is left with a great deal of uncompensated care.
Hoy says one of the coalition's greatest concerns is that Medicaid reductions, including the elimination of the Affordable Care Act subsidies, will squeeze out New York's smaller and rural hospitals, which are highly dependent on Medicaid.
And they're likely going to close or going to cut services or become urgent care centers.
The issue of whether the subsidies will be extended is now at the heart of the current government shutdown. And in less than a month, open enrollment starts for those insurance plans. If the subsidies do expire, many lower and middle income people will be in for some hefty sticker shock soon. Amy Feiereisel for the New York Public News Network.
Well, healthcare and the government shutdown certainly making headlines, but what about disposable styrofoam coolers, school meals, payroll rules? Those may not make the evening news, but they affect New Yorkers every day. The Capitol Press Room is the daily show looking at issues like those and more, and it's joining our schedule on Monday. We'll introduce you to the show's host, David Lombardo, next. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Hey there, it's Jason Dole again, and I am excited to announce WJFF Fest, the benefit concert for Radio Catskill, happening at New Memories in Parksville the night of October 12th, featuring a phenomenal lineup of local bands, including CRISPR, Creatures, Basic Bitches, Edison Rocket Train, Open to Suggestions, and more. Tickets are $10. All proceeds go to the station. We are going to get loud for public radio, and I want you to be there with me. 5 to 9, October 12th at New Memories in Parksville.
You're with Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Capitol Press Room is joining Radio Catskill's daily schedule starting Monday, offering listeners a closer look at state government and policy issues that often fly under the radar. Dave Lombardo, host of the show, said the program aims to cover both headline-grabbing developments and the nuanced issues that affect everyday New Yorkers. He spoke with our own Jason Dole.
David Lombardo, Capitol Press Room, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Glad to be part of this.
Capital Press Room's joining our daily schedule here at Radio Catskill. So I'll say, like, congrats and thanks for doing this work so that we can share it with our listeners.
Well, no, I'm really appreciative of the opportunity to reach more New Yorkers. I think what we're doing here with the Capital Press Room is really fun and kind of unique in the sense that we're touching on all of the different aspects of state government and how they interact with people's lives. There's the big things that may be getting some attention, but then there's a lot of stuff that flies below the radar. And that's some of the stuff that we try to shine a spotlight on, in part because we got a lot of airtime to fill.
I want to get some examples of that. But first, could you give people just like the overview of like, how did Capital Press Room get started? How did you get started with it? What's the bigger picture of your story?
So Capital Press Room has been around for about a decade and a half. It was started by Susan Arbetter, who people may know as a voice in public media from her time with WAMC in the Capital Region, or then as host of New York Now on PBS affiliates. Most recently, she's worked as the host of Capital Tonight, and she launched this as a public affairs program that was designed to bring in policymakers, stakeholders from around the state, and have conversations that were maybe a little more in depth than people might be used to normally for their state government coverage. And now, for almost 6 years, I've been really in a role to carry on that legacy that Susan left. And we've tried to put our own spin on it with my own sense of humor, maybe a little bit, my own interests, my own background. I bring about a decade and a half of Capital experience. I've worked at newspapers around the Capital region. I've worked for online outlets. I even spent about a month and a half working, a year and a half working inside the state legislature, which really helped my understanding of Albany and how things work here at the Capitol. So we try to give a show that is both accessible to a broader audience, but also maybe interesting to insiders who know how the sausage is made, so to speak.
Well, it's a sausage capital, isn't it, Albany? Like, things are messy there. I'll say, like, my own journey with the local edition and our local news here, we've only been doing it for about 5 years now. And it was a little bit before that time where I felt like I wasn't really paying that much attention to state news. We didn't have a lot of that here on the station. We started doing more local news. We realized it was really important to cover what's going on in Albany. A lot of that coverage is just trying to get people to understand how kind of messy it is. So that said, we've been talking a lot about some of the big name stuff that people might be hearing in other places that's coming out Albany. What are some examples of some of the more nuanced things that you like to get into that people may not be aware of?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. So one of the ways that we try to stay on top of things that people might not necessarily be aware of is we take a look at the rules and regulations that different state agencies are promulgating. And sometimes this means how we're implementing high level bills that people paid a lot of attention to, and there's going to be focus on them, like restrictions on social media access for minors. Those rules are being promulgated, and we're going to obviously cover those. But they're also putting out rules right now, state environmental officials, on restrictions to disposable styrofoam coolers. People may not be aware of this, but starting in 2026, you're not going to be able to buy a disposable styrofoam cooler if you want to go have a picnic in the park and keep drinks cool. And this falls in line with other things that the state has done, restricting styrofoam food containers, packing peanuts. And so we try to be that awareness feature for people. I think of another one. We recently covered legislation that deals with in-state disadvantages that payroll processing companies face compared to out-of-state payroll processing companies. And this is one where even the bill sponsor was telling us how this is a super wonky issue. Most people don't even realize that something that state tax and finance department did a few years ago is costing businesses in New York millions of dollars. And we're shining a spotlight on that, but also trying to elevate voices who maybe don't necessarily have a platform in Albany. These groups that come to Albany every year, those people know how to get media attention. And so we're trying to look beyond that and elevate some voices that maybe aren't necessarily getting a lot of attention. Maybe their issues are, but they're not the people whose perspectives are being heard. So that's another thing we're focusing on here.
You want to talk a little bit about who you turn to have these conversations, like what sorts of guests you have on and where they come from?
Yeah, so we range from the policymakers themselves. We have the Senate Majority Leader here in the state Senate, Andrea Stewart-Cousins, a Westchester County Democrat, on, to the food director for a Capital Region school district who's explaining how the implementation of universal school meals is actually going. What is it like to get beyond that headline around $340 million for universal access to breakfast and lunch in schools? And what is it actually like? And for example, we learned that demand is higher than what people thought. And so they're going to be asking probably for more money in the future. But in terms of finding voices, one of the things that I do that I think, you know, a lot of my colleagues aren't necessarily looking for is the state lobbying records. And this is a treasure trove of information because you get to pull behind the curtain and see who's actually spending money to influence the agenda here in Albany. Clearly, there are people who are having rallies and want attention, but there are many people who are working behind the scenes. But because of our disclosure laws, they have to register what they're doing. And so we find a lot of guests that way. Sometimes people want to remain, you know, behind the curtains and turn us down. But a lot of people then, you know, step up and say, okay, I'll tell you why, you know, we're opposed to this or why we're supportive of this. And sometimes it can be a surprise. We talk about an issue like awareness about the possible pain with an IUD insertion. This is something that was never something I dealt with in my personal life, but it was something that Democrats in New York were advocating for because there was this idea that women weren't necessarily going into these appointments with doctors armed with all the information that they needed to be good advocates. And you think, okay, no brainer. This is something everyone's rallying behind. Well, it turns out that the OBGYNs in New York, they're actually opposed to this. They don't like this mandate. And so we had them on to talk about this issue and try to bring some nuance and a deeper understanding to what's going on here.
And, you know, public radio's got the time and the space for that. That's something that just doesn't happen in a lot of the other more visible and flashy outlets out there.
Where pretty flashy, Jason. Pretty flashy.
Good. Okay. You bring the flash to public radio. That's why we're bringing you on here.
Yeah, that's the plan. And because what you say is kind of my issue with some of the coverage, which is that it is sort of rote. It follows a script, so to speak. I can tell you what the first three questions someone might ask and then those first three answers. And you're not surprised. And I think even listeners kind of get used to that. And I think it almost turns people off to a certain degree, because even if they don't know exactly what the person is saying, they don't know the topic, it all sounds so rehearsed. And so one of the things that we try to do is break from that. We try to not fall into the same mold. And so whether it's the guests that we're having on or the questions that we're asking, we try to deviate. We try to be maybe uncomfortable to a certain degree. We try to step out of that box. I think of the fact we just had the new state museum director on the show, and that's going to be an important position here in Albany. The museum's at a point of inflection. And one of the things I was curious was, how much are you going to make for this? It wasn't announced. And a lot of people are kind of uncomfortable with that. And I just asked the question and, you know, nobody got too mad. And she answered the best of her ability or the best that she wanted to. And we moved on. So I think that's one of the things that we try to do. Maybe it's not flashy, but hopefully it's interesting.
I'd like to take a moment just to talk about just some of the issues that are going around New York and just pick your brain for a moment quickly on each of them. But starting semi-broadly still, one of the truisms in New York State and New York and state governance, ongoing sagas, is always Albany and the city, the back and forth between New York City and Albany, sometimes a friction, sometimes a partnerships. Where are you seeing things at right now, and how do you approach talking about Albany and New York City?
So right now, I think the relationship remains a pretty positive one. This governor, upon taking over for Andrew Cuomo, really wanted to set a different tone than her predecessor, who was openly antagonistic with New York City Mayor Eric Adams's predecessor, Bill de Blasio. And despite the corruptions and differences maybe of opinion that Hochul and Adams have had, they've remained pretty good working allies. Now the question remains to be seen, though, is what is that relationship going to be like in 2026 and beyond, when potentially the occupant of Gracie Manor is going to be a Democratic socialist in Zoran Mamdani, the Democratic nominee? At this point, it seems like the governor is going out of her way to highlight the areas where they can work together. And Zoran Mamdani, for his part, is talking about the need to collaborate, in part because he really does need Albany to get some of his agenda through. I'm more curious about how the legislature approaches this, because I think that's where you can see a variety of opinions that might complicate efforts to have constantly a kumbaya moment between the governor and mayor.
Speaking of the legislature, one of the big questions all summer long is the legislature going to reconvene? Is it going to call another session to meet up and deal with the budget hole that's been left by some of the changes and the defunding from Washington, D.C.? And that's kind of been a question that's floating around. Is it still floating around, or is anything more definitive about that? Are you still asking that question?
If that proposal isn't dead, it's on life support. I would say that this is one of those issues where, from an outsider, you say, wow, they need to make up a big budget hole that is going to be present for this current fiscal year that goes through March 31st and is going to be even bigger in the new fiscal year that starts in April. But in reality, the way the budget is implemented, the Hochul administration and their budget officials have a wide latitude to withhold some money, tap into reserves. And then there's the fact that state lawmakers, they don't want to be the bad guy. They don't want to have to come back to Albany and say, hey, we've got $750 million we got to make up, and so we're going to cut XYZ programs. They defer that responsibility all day long. They want to be able to point the finger at the governor, point the finger at DC, and say, hey, it's not me that's cutting your favorite program. It's not me that's lowering Medicaid reimbursement rates for something. It's the governor. So I think most people didn't actually expect them to come back unless the cuts were a lot more dramatic and more immediate than they actually were.
Another issue we're still covering, I feel like the state is still reacting to, and the state's carceral system is still reacting to, is that wildcat strike that happened earlier in the year, statewide corrections officers strike. I'm wondering if you're watching anything along those lines at the state level.
Yeah, we're definitely paying a lot of attention to the state prison system, which I think was probably an underreported issue prior to the strikes that happened this year. And one of the things that we're going to be focusing on moving forward is actually a report that came out from the Justice Center for the Protection of People with Special Needs. They're actually responsible for monitoring some of the mental health services that are provided in prisons, as well as the implementation of the solitary confinement reforms that took effect a few years ago. And that report, which is done by state officials, so you might think it would be more charitable to state officials, is pretty critical of what's been rolling out here. And I think that's going to be one of those areas that really highlights the divisions between prison officials and the advocates for vulnerable people in New York. But yeah, the idea that we have a real problem in our prisons, whether it's staffing or the number of facilities, remains an open question without a lot of good answers. And one of the unknown variables at this point is how the governor is going to act on a package of prison reforms that were adopted in the closing days of the legislative session here in Albany. The package did not go as far as progressive criminal justice advocates had hoped, but it still may be too far for this governor, who I think is more comfortable in embracing the position of, say, prison staff than the incarcerated population.
In recent weeks, maybe the past month or so, it seems that State Comptroller DiNapoli has released reports and statements that are fairly critical of different aspects of state health care infrastructure, Office of the Aging, and of course, there's the whole home care issue. Just seems like, oh boy, I'm hearing a lot from the comptroller about this. I'm wondering if you noticed this, if you're picking up anything on where things stand with health care at the state level.
Well, if it's a day ending in Y, you can usually bet that there is some sort of audit or review going on by the state comptroller's office into the delivery of healthcare in New York. And for years, whether it's the Hochul administration, the Cuomo administration, the Patterson administration, you can trust that there were reports coming out about wasted dollars, a lack of efficiency in the healthcare system. So that isn't necessarily a surprise to me that the comptroller has been putting out reports on these issues. I've been a little surprised that he hasn't leaned more into the rollout and implementation of changes to the so-called consumer-directed personal assistance program, a home care program that serves about 250,000 New Yorkers. We actually had him on the show and mixed it up a little bit on this idea that why aren't you doing more of a real-time audit of this transition? And he made the case that more of his work has to be done retrospectively. And I think because of that, we're going to see a lot more audits from him on this topic, maybe 12, 18 months down the road. But you mentioned the comptroller, and I do think we have seen him be a little more active on certain issues where he's been getting hit from his left, because there have now been at least two people who have emerged with an interest in primarying the longtime Democratic leader. And they've talked about his failure from their eyes to return more of New York's unclaimed funds. This is money that people are entitled to. It's sitting in a big pot, although some of it's actually being spent as part of the budget. And there's a critique that the controller should be distributing more of this money faster. And we've actually seen him kind of be responsive to that critique and be more proactive and a little more public with those efforts.
I've got two more for you if you've got the time here for it.
All the time for you. If you're going to let me talk, I'll fill that void, whatever it is. I'm like a gas, man. You give me an empty space, I'll fill it.
For another kind of truism, at least, you know, in recent years, is that Albany's majority Democrat. You know, it's a blue state. The Republicans are these years in kind of perennial minority status. What are their prospects? What are you hearing from Republicans in New York State of what their strategy is moving forward? What are you thinking?
Well, the road to power for New York Republicans is primarily focused on Washington, D.C., because here in New York, whether it's the Assembly, where Democrats control more than 100 of 150 seats, or in the state Senate, depending on the number of seats currently filled, Democrats have about 39 or 40 of the 63 seats. The road to power is long, and I don't see where it actually ends. It's a completely different dynamic from just 6-7 years ago, when Republicans had basically had an uninterrupted 40 or 50 year control of the state Senate, despite the demographics of the state. But with the changing demographics in 2018, the Democrats took control of all the levers of power here in Albany and took it with very sizable majorities. And now that they control the redistricting process, despite what you hear about so-called independent commissions, they're in a good place to maintain that control. Maybe Republicans can slowly chip away at some of the seats in the Hudson Valley and some of the upstate cities. Maybe they can make inroads into ethnic minority communities in New York City. But that is a long process, and it's one in which I will have hopefully been on the air for many years in the Catskills before that actually happens, because it's going to be a long time coming.
And finally, just want your thoughts on Governor Hochul, how she's doing, what she's facing. We're, you know, about a year out from a gubernatorial race here in New York State. What are you thinking about how Governor Hochul's doing?
So this governor has been pretty consistent with her approach to policymaking, in the sense that she's really leaned into using the budget as her cudgel with the state legislature. And she has, to, you know, her credit, stayed pretty consistent with the values that she's had all the way since when she was a Erie County clerk. And that means she's been a pretty much a centrist Democrat. She likens herself to someone like FDR. We see some moderation of that to the left and right on various issues. But I think come a year from now, we're going to be talking about Governor Kathy Hochul in probably a pretty strong position for reelection to another 4 years. There's the possibility of a primary challenge from her lieutenant governor, Antonio Delgado. He plans on coming at her from the left. I think she's in a pretty good shape to hold him off, because I don't think he's has the grassroots populism appeal of someone like Zora Mamdani in New York City. And then thinking about the general election, while all eyes are on Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, a North Country Republican, as the likely Republican challenger, I would put some money, if you're taking bets, and we actually do like to talk about political gambling occasionally on this show, on the Nassau County Republican executive, Bruce Blakeman. With the way that Congresswoman Elise Stefanik has postured around this race, the fact that she hasn't declared for the race now that it's only 14 months out, makes me think that some of this is all about posturing for Bruce Blakeman down on Long Island, who has to run for reelection before he could really declare for another race, which is a possibility moving forward. So I'm not saying it's what's going to happen. You know, it could be Stefanik versus Hochul in 2026. But, you know, if you want a long shot call from your new radio host right now, watch for Bruce Blakeman versus Kathy Hochul.
been talking to David Lombardo from Capital Press Room. Capital Press Room's daily show streams at capitalpressroom.org, and you can hear the show weekday afternoons at 1 right here on Radio Catskill starting Monday. David, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us, and welcome to the schedule.
My pleasure, and thanks for letting me be part of your organization.
And we're looking forward to that premiering Monday at 1 on Radio Catskill. We'll take a break, and when we come back, Honesdale Rotary's Jim Hamill joins us live to talk about the club's mission, upcoming events, and how you can get involved. This is Radio Catskill.
This week on This American Life, when Zoran Mamdani won the primary race for New York mayor a couple months ago, the Democratic establishment didn't exactly embrace him. And it made me think of another charismatic, unconventional candidate years ago who the same thing happened to.
I saw a man, he danced with his wife in Chicago.
Chicago's first black mayor, Harold Washington. How that played after him this week.
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Now we're talking about community service and giving back. Joining us live is Jim Hamill from the Rotary Club of Honesdale to share what makes the Rotary unique among civic organizations, what events are coming up, and what the Rotary's motto, service above self, really means for Honesdale. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Jim, thanks for having us on, man.
And let's explain to folks who may not be familiar with the Rotary Club, how does it compare to other civic groups?
Well, sure, there are civic groups throughout, you know, the country and even in Wayne County and the northeast part of Pennsylvania. But the Rotary Club is international. It has such a large mission globally, but then on a local scale, each club is made up of, you know, a few dozen members who meet, whether it's, you know, two to three times a month to have that fellowship and have that camaraderie, but then to go out into the community with service projects. And so the Rotary Club is very welcoming to anybody who would like to be a member of the Rotary Club. It does not, you know, have any prerequisite other than that you want to give back to your community. And so that's a really great opportunity to serve and support various projects, whether it's beautification in the town of Honesdale, where we kind of are hyper-located. But then throughout the rest of the community, we support other charitable organizations like Victims Intervention Program or scholarships for high school students and the like. So there's so many different ways to be a Rotarian. And we have that global mission, but it's also a local mission as well.
Are you celebrating any milestones soon?
Yeah, absolutely. In just about a year, we'll be celebrating our 100th anniversary as a club. And that's a really amazing feat to say we've been around for a century and have been a service-oriented organization, giving of ourselves to the community in various ways, adopting various parks or pavilions and being stewards of those in the community, but also then providing for support to various organizations, you know, that need the financial support or otherwise. So the 100th year will be a very big celebration that we'll have much more to come on as far as planning goes, because, you know, 2026 is a very big year in the country, celebrating 250 years of the American, Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we have our 100th year kind of coinciding. So that's really exciting times.
You guys aren't resting, though, and waiting until next year. You do events every year. What are some of the annual events you have? What do you have coming up?
Yeah, so we just wrapped up our third annual Honesdale Beer and Wine Fest at the Wayne County Fairgrounds with hundreds of folks coming on out to support that great cause. We have, you know, a couple dozen vendors, few food artisans, and especially the beer, wine, and spirits, and bands. And that really raised thousands of dollars. It's our largest fundraiser of the year. So we had great weather for the first time in 3 years, and it was a huge turnout, and we really appreciated the response from everybody. That's looking in the rear view, but looking ahead, we have some pretty unique stuff coming, things coming up on the calendar. We have our pet parade, which is a really fun one that we've been doing for a few years as well in Honesdale Central Park. We bring out all the, animal lovers, dog lovers, in this parade on the 11th of October. Rain date is the next day, Sunday the 12th. We coincide with Harvest and Heritage Day, the Greater Honesdale Partnership hosts in town. So there's a lot of activity happening throughout Honesdale on the 11th. 11:30 is registration. The parade starts at noon, and there's prizes for best costume, best couple, funniest costume, longest treat pause, best wiggle of the butt, and the longest sit and stay. And so the funds raised there, they support Deaf and Animal Shelter and other projects in our community as well. So it's a really exciting time to share in the beautiful park that is there, Central Park. That's something that we've supported through some donations of some dog waste receptacles and bags to pick up after those pups.
Right.
And it's really great to see these dogs come on out with their owners. And last year we had like a Travis Kelce and a Taylor Swift themed dog couple that really took the cake there.
You might have another one given the pending nuptials, or maybe, you know, life of a show dog. Before we go,
I would imagine.
Before we go, let's tell folks how they can become a member or get more information about the Rotary Club of Honesdale.
Yeah, the Rotary Club of Honesdale is socially active on social media, but also, like I said, meets twice a month, the second Wednesday of the month at noon at TikToks on Terrace, and the fourth Wednesday in the evening about 5:30, also at TikToks on Terrace. We welcome anybody to join us for these meetings. Those lunch meetings, you know, they involve some programs, some speakers, and then it's just great to be able to join in something that is, it's not a prerequisite to be there at every meeting. So you come when you can and you support the different initiatives that you can. We also have something that I failed to mention. AMBA is a great event we have coming up later on this month as well in Honesdale at Grace Episcopal Church. It's a panel screening where people could pay one price and get a whole litany of different aspects of their health when they do that. So that's a really great thing happening at the Grace Episcopal Church that is happening. Let's see here. I just want to double check the date so I have it correct. It is October 25th, Saturday morning. That's pretty much running, you know, quite a long morning there, 5:30 a.m. to 10:15 a.m. So you can find out more online at honesdalerotary.com.
That's Jim Hamill of the Honesdale Rotary. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jim. Have a good one.
And now turning to our homegrown Hurleyville singer-songwriter, Michaela Rain. She'll be playing a one-night-only set at the Hurleyville Performing Arts Center tomorrow. Radio Catskills' Genevieve Hartnett spoke with Michaela ahead of the event about finding her love for music in the Catskills and a revealing new side of her artistry to her hometown.
For Michaela Rain, music has always been a passion. But even more, a way to constantly grow. Playing over 5 instruments, as well as being a singer-songwriter, she's constantly looking to go new places with her music.
Take all of my time. I don't mind.
You're hearing her song, I Have Returned For You, My Love. Just one of many that she will be playing this Friday for a one-night-only concert at the Hurleyville Performing Arts Center.
I kind of wanted to just learn a little bit more about your artistic background. Like, when did you know music was a path for you? When did you come to really love music?
I love answering that question because, for me, it always brings me back. I was like one of those kids who would sing around the house just for absolutely no reason. But I didn't really know it was something I wanted to do with my life until I was probably, I think I was 6 when I did my first musical. And I was on the stage and I remember looking out into the lights and being like, oh, this is what home feels like. This is amazing. Like being on the stage, looking at the lights, singing, acting. And of course, at that time, I didn't understand this is something you can do for the rest of your life. So I think once I did, I was like, wait, that's an option. And it really just stuck with me ever since.
I'm curious to learn a little bit more about the show you're going to be doing on Friday night. Is it similar to the one that you've done around the country? What can people expect from it?
Yeah, so the show on Friday is going to be unlike anything that I have ever done before. And I say that because, you know, if you've come to my gigs before, you maybe have seen me play the drums, you've definitely seen me play guitar, you probably have seen me play piano, but you've never seen me perform my music on a stage this way. And you've never seen the number of new songs that I'm doing is probably more than half of the set is something you've never heard before. So it's definitely very, very new. And also with HPAC having the cinema, which is where the show is going to be, we have use of the projector, which is, I'm not going to spoil anything, but it'll be part of the show. It's going to be really fun. And I'm very excited about that also because it really sets the stage. And coming from a theater background, I feel like this show for me is kind of merging those two. I get to do my songs and I get to play my instruments, but I also get to have that little bit of a theatrical effect with the lighting and the background that I have never had before. So it's definitely going to be a show to remember for sure.
What was it that made it so important for you to debut this experience here in Sullivan County?
Yeah, I mean, definitely the fact that it's my hometown has a huge part of it. Like I said, I grew up here. I grew up in the theater in South Fallsburg. And when I was a kid in Hurleyville, they didn't have anything like this. And so now that especially HPAC is really dedicated to giving a space for artists and creativity. And I appreciate that so much coming from Hurleyville when it wasn't a thing when I was a kid. I love so much that I'm able to be a part of that now.
Obviously, the town knows you, that you grew up here. What do you hope, you know, after you've had a lot of performing experience all around the country, what are you hoping audiences who maybe know you as a person already, what are you hoping that they maybe get to see more of in this performance?
A little bit about how I've grown, and it's a little bit about the things that I've been unable to show until now. Because most of the songs that I'm doing, either if I don't play like the electric guitar live, it's in the track that I have. I have tracks that I've recorded and produced all of the music that you're gonna hear. So with the exception of a couple of covers that I might do live, any of the tracks you hear overhead during the concert, I produced and wrote myself, and I played all of the instruments for that. I'm especially excited to be able to share some of the more upbeat and like full tracks that I've never gotten to show before because I was only able to play one instrument live. And so I definitely am excited to have everybody who's been so supportive of me, who's come to my gigs where I'm just playing the guitar and appreciating it and supporting me and loving me anyway, be able to see this kind of finished piece the way that I wish I could share more normally. So a song that I might do all the time now, you're going to hear more aspects of it, which is really important, especially harmonies for me is a huge thing. If you listen to my music, like almost every single song has harmonies and they always kind of make the song for me. So to be able to show that, to have a couple of harmonies in some of the tracks is, I'm really, really excited for that.
You're in New York City now and you're doing the show and you've been performing all around the country. What is next for you? What is your goal for the next couple of years? Where do you hope to take this, to take performing?
I see this concert very much as a start. Once we do the concert, I'll have the set list, the layout, kind of the groundwork. And I would love to take it somewhere else in that, whether it's in the area or if it's outside, I would love to do the show again once it's done. And also to add some variations to it. I'm the kind of person who, like I mentioned earlier, that half of the set is like new songs. I kind of have to show you new stuff. Like, not because I feel like I need to for any specific reason, just because I really enjoy saying, hey, look at this song I just wrote. And so I say now I would love to do the concert again, but most likely if I did, it would have more new songs added to it. And then also being in New York City, you know, I've just done a lot of traveling. I was in Hawaii for 5 months and I went to Japan for a little bit. And then I came back and I spent a lot of time upstate for the summer teaching with Bethel and really just having a music filled summer. And so going back to the city also is a little bit of a fresh start because I get to go back to the same acting and like music things that I was doing with a new outlook and expand from there also. So you definitely, I feel like, can expect to see me on some stages in the city soon and some screens maybe if I do some film. I really feel like the world is my oyster at this point. So very excited to have this beginning.
I have returned for you.
Michaela, thank you very, very much for joining us today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
In Liberty, I'm Genevieve Hartnett for Radio Catskill.
Thanks for that report. Hometown girl does good. That's good to hear. That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support comes from Tavern on Main, a neighborhood bar and grill on Main Street in Jeffersonville, featuring local beers on tap, weekend brunch, heated patio seating, and a backyard with fire pit. Menu and hours at tavernonmainny.com.
This is Radio Catskill, your NPR station, made possible by listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.